Welcome in. We're live from Madison Square Garden here doing one of these midday podcasts. Xavier will tip off at 9:30 p.m. tonight against Butler. Right now, we are currently watching Villanova and Marquette wrap up the first game of today's action. Catching up on some action from last night, Marquette beat Seton Hall 78-56. And Dan, this game was pretty much just the Matt Carlino show. He was fun to watch.
Yeah, Carlino tied Dana Barros' record with 8 threes in a game. That's the most in biggest tournament history. Carlino and Marquette really did a nice job attacking Seton Hall. But for me, the big story other than Carlino shooting was the fact that Seton Hall team looked tired of one another's company and didn't seem real rattled by the fact that their season was coming to an end. It certainly fits with the narrative we've seen around them over the last 2 months.
Yeah, I think, you know, so many people have talked about it and taken shots without necessarily being around the program to know. You can, obviously, with what happened with Jaren Cena, you can draw your own conclusions. But after watching them last night, I would tend to believe most of the things I've heard about that program are as bad as it sounded, because they looked like a team that didn't want to play together. You hit the nail on the head.
Yeah, and Marquette did pretty well last night. Of course, they've turned around today and just been on the receiving end of a boat racing from Villanova. But let's talk about the second game last night. Creighton beats DePaul, final score 78-63. Pretty interesting game. I think a real clash of styles between Creighton's more deliberate perimeter-based offense and DePaul really wanting to get up and down the floor. You know, the issue with DePaul, as always, is they play like an AAU team.
Yep.
You know, you roll the ball to the center court and got live action. And Creighton just absolutely annihilated them in the half court, especially in the second half of that game.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing about this Creighton team is over the last, I don't know, maybe month and a half of the season, it's felt like they had maybe turned a corner and were progressing and getting better. And, you know, last night I think we saw that. They looked like a pretty good team. I mean, they looked like a legitimate contender in this tournament. And James Milliken, I mentioned this, I think, when I did the first matchups this year, the Xavier Creighton game. James Milliken is a guy that gives Creighton that extra offensive burst on certain nights where he can go create his own shot, and it makes the rest of their more systematic shooters and passers and cutters a lot more difficult to guard when you've got to worry about locking him up one-on-one with the way he was playing last night. He finished 8 of 14 from the field and 3 of 6 from beyond the arc.
So those were last night's games. Unfortunately, we had 3 blowouts so far in this tournament. As we said, right now 79-47, Villanova leading Marquette with 2 minutes left. This game has just been all Villanova. Some bizarre tactical decisions by Steve Wojciechowski,
to say the least,
to play zone for most of the game and just kind of allow Nova to step into threes, and they dug themselves a gigantic hole in the first half. But this is just last year Villanova was the number one seed coming into the tournament, and they really played very lethargic against Seton Hall. Eventually, you know, they were down 15 the first half. They came back to tie it, but Sterling Gibbs won it at the buzzer. This has been a completely different performance than that one from Villanova. They just are so assured, and they move the ball so well. They play as a team. They just seem to be completely locked in, and that's why they're going to go to 30-2 in about a minute.
Yeah, I think the thing you said is just how sort of confident and carefree they look. I mean, they started this game, and you mentioned Marquette came out in that zone, and it was like Villanova was just so settled in the offensive end. It was pass, 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 guy spaces out and hits a three. And it was that way every possession for the first half of the game.
And the other thing is, I think, if anything, their defensive effort has been more impressive than what they've done offensively in this game. Carlino's big offensive night last night. He didn't get a clean look the first 26 minutes of the game. Actually, he's checking out now, getting hugs from his teammates in his last college game. Matt Carlino just could not get off today, and without him, Marquette really doesn't have much offensively. They just have a lot of pieces, guys that can't really score, and if Carlino can't get his shots, they're going to really struggle to string together consecutive baskets and make the kind of runs that you would need to put a charge in a team like Villanova.
Yeah, I think it impressed me how easily Villanova was able to take him out of the game without selling out on the defensive end. I mean, they looked fine. They weren't out of sorts chasing him around those cuts or anything, but they were able to keep the ball out of his hands and prevent him from getting any open good looks. And that was really the difference and what kept Marquette from ever getting into this game. Well, that's pretty much where we're at.
Yeah. Like, let's talk about the other. So tipping off next in probably about 45 minutes will be St. John's and Providence. Rick, your quick thoughts on that game?
I think it's going to be the most fun game of the first round. I think it's kind of different styles. I don't think that Providence matches up all that well with St. John's. But at the same time, what St. John's team are we going to see? And I'm interested to see what the atmosphere is going to be like in the arena. It's a really good crowd already. They were here early today. As you mentioned, there will likely be some more St. John's people filling in here in the next hour for that next ball game. I think it's going to be a pretty great atmosphere.
Yeah, I mean, I'm guessing the lower bowl is, I'm going to say, 85% full, and the upper decks are very full as well. I mean, this is a nice crowd for quarterfinal afternoon. Yeah, I agree with you. I like Providence to win the second game, although it will be a little bit of a hostile environment. I just think that Ed Cooley has certainly demonstrated last year his ability to game plan, and Steve Lavin, you know, it's kind of just what team shows up. So I'll take Providence.
Yeah, I think, St. John's, if I'm not mistaken, pulling up right now here, I believe they beat Providence both times that they played during the Big East season. Yeah, they did. They beat them 75-66 the second time they played, 83-70 the first time they played. So, I mean, St. John's clearly has some advantages against this Providence team matchup-wise. But, again, I go back to St. John's is inconsistent, and Levante Hinton is in his final Big East tournament at Madison Square Garden. I expect some big things out of him today.
Well, certainly the big advantage that they'll have is the matchup of so if he can stay on the floor, I think we'll have a pretty major advantage in that. I've got to help the five.
Yeah, without question. And obviously, Xavier will be the late game at 9:30.
The third quarter will be Creighton and Georgetown. And I think you got to be on upset alert in this game a little bit. Creighton, as we talked about, has been very improved over the last all 6 weeks of the season. The games they lost generally been very close. Georgetown can be a little bit enigmatic themselves in terms of what team shows up. But certainly it'll be interesting to see how Devontae Smith Rivera, that matchup between him and Chapman looks. And I think Milliken is the key player for Creighton, I think. Because if he can play in Chad, he can convince his hand for two or three spots.
Yeah, I think I would agree with that. When you talk about these matchups, Georgetown beat Creighton twice, obviously, but they did not play each other. Their last game was January 31st. So they didn't play each other really any sort of in that later part of the season where we're talking about Creighton really started improving and things seemed to click. I tend to think Georgetown will win this game, but I agree with you that if it's the same Creighton team that we saw last night, they can keep it close because Georgetown isn't a really tough team to match up with. They don't have super athletes. DSR is obviously a great scorer, but he's not an impossible guard. You can keep a guy on him, you can stay with him, he's not super athletic. Josh Smith, obviously, when he's at his best, can be a difficult matchup. But to me, I think Creighton, this is a game they can stay in as long as they can hit some outside shots.
Yeah, and Creighton's got bodies they can throw at Josh Smith. I mean, they do have a decent amount of size on the bench with Brazil and with
Martino.
And they've got some big fours as well.
That's an impressive, yeah.
So, I mean, they can bring bodies at him, but whether or not they'll really be able to keep Georgetown off the board is the question. So the late game, Xavier and Butler, leading for the third time this season. Musketeers, of course, beaten pretty soundly at Hinkle Fieldhouse early in the Big East schedule, 88-76. That was a game where Xavier gave up 55 points in the second half. They sent Butler to the line 42 times for 32 makes. I'm reminded of Skip Rosser's old saying that if you make more free throws than the other team shoots, you're probably going to win. Butler made 32 in that game, and Xavier shot 25. So
I think that's going to be a An important part of this game, though, is the way it's officiated this time. Because that first game at Butler, there were a ton of fouls called. I think like 60-plus fouls called. And then in the second game, there were only 32, if I'm not mistaken. So it was definitely officiated differently. If Xavier is allowed to be physical, if Jalen Reynolds and Matt Stainberg don't get in early foul trouble, they play with confidence and are allowed to play aggressive and physical down low, I think that really benefits Xavier. Both of those guys, though, have shown tendencies this year that if they get an early foul or they get a call that doesn't go their way, they tend to maybe lose their cool a little bit and struggle from that point on. So I think that's going to be a big part, is how the officials handle the first few minutes of this game with the way they're calling it.
And I would say that, you know, in the second game, Xavier, of course, won pretty handily over Butler at Cintas Center, 73-56. That was a game where Kellen Dunham got in early foul trouble. Chris Holman brought him back at the end of the half, trying to keep pace. He picks up a third foul. That really put Butler behind the eight ball. Of course, they also played that game without Andrew Travis, who is a guy that really kind of has a multiplier effect on his teammates because he is so good at distributing the ball, making his own shot when he has a favorable matchup. He just really runs the show for them. He's almost like a point center, you could almost say. Kind of the same role as Stainbrook fills for Xavier. So it'll be, and that, so how Xavier is going to guard him, guard Cameron Woods, is going to be a fascinating tactical matchup to see how Chris Mack goes about that, because that's where this game, I think, is going to be won and lost. Dunham will get his, probably, but Xavier's ability to stop Butler's secondary scorers and Travis and Woods would be a huge factor in how this game goes.
Yeah, we talked about that on the last DNB podcast earlier this week when we were previewing this game a little bit with Snow. I think Snow mentioned the fact that Xavier is going to use Stainbrook on Woods and just treat him like the center instead of the power forward, because he is not a guy who faces up and creates his own shot, even though he is a tough guard for Stainbrook because of his quickness and athleticism. They're better off putting, whether it's Blewett or whoever's playing the four, Jalen Reynolds or James Farr, on Travis, because of his ability to face up and, like you mentioned, his ability to do things for his teammates and make plays for other guys. I think you're right. The first game, Xavier didn't get beat by one guy, but they let five different Butler players have a big night. You can't do that against this Butler team. If Donovan has a big night, that's fine. If Travis has a big night, that's fine. You can't let three or four of them disrupt you. The big key to that is stopping Roosevelt Jones from creating all that stuff, because when he gets in the lane and he can collapse your defense, Butler is a difficult team to guard, because now you do have an elite shooter on the outside, you do have a forward who can score, and you do have a long and athletic big man that you can dump the ball off to or just get up off the backboard and let him go get a tip dunk if your defense isn't in a position to box him out. So again, as much as we talk about these other guys, Travis and Dunham, Roosevelt Jones is still a huge key to slowing down this Butler team.
Another place that Xavier's going to have to win an individual matchup is at the one. D. Davis, all year we've seen him basically have his ups and downs. I think more ups than downs, but generally this season. But if he can be productive and efficient, I think it will really help Xavier win this game, because he can break Barlow down, and he can certainly play Barlow very close on the offensive end if he draws that matchup. I guess it depends on whether or not they elect to put Abel on Dunham or have D guard Dunham as they did last year. But I think that's an area where Xavier's got an advantage, and they need to press that advantage because Butler causes some problems for the Xavier team at some other positions, particularly Roosevelt Jones.
Yeah, and I would agree with that. It was interesting, too, in that second game when you talk about how they matched up with Roosevelt Jones. Miles Davis started off guarding him and received some good help from his teammates. And then when Dunham got that third foul for that last four-minute war of the first half, they went to that 1-3-1 and really clogged up those driving lanes and took away the passing lanes for Jones with some of the length when they had Reynolds in the middle and Stainbrook on the bottom of that zone. So I'm interested to see how much they try to mix in the zone with the man-to-man. And I would, again, expect that they put Miles Davis, on Roosevelt Jones and then try to offer as much help as possible in the gaps from D. Davis and Remy Abel. And another thing with D. Davis offensively, you were talking about, first game he took over 10 shots. Second game he took four.
That's usually a bad thing to say. It's weird. It's weird to say this about a productive player, but it seems like the more field goal attempts D. Davis takes, the worst sign it is for Xavier in terms of the flow of their offense.
And that's exactly what it is. I don't think it's as much about D. Davis's decision-making in those games as it is what the other teams have done to Xavier and what they've stopped. Because when D is taking a lot of shots, that means basically they have taken away the passing lanes, they've taken away the ball screen offense by downing those screens, and D is now trying to drive basically they're daring D to drive to the rim and figure it out, and hoping that they can block his shot once he gets there and take away his passing lane so he can't kick it back out. So I do think that'll obviously be a big key as well. But last time, Xavier didn't need D to run the offense. They just played through Stainbrook and let him attack, and I think that'll be the same strategy we see tonight on the offensive end.
A lot of big conference tournaments getting started today. The Big East obviously finishes up on Saturday night. A lot of the other bigger conferences have their title games on Sunday. I think the one takeaway I've had from Champions Week this year has been we haven't really seen a whole lot of those bid stealers, and I think this may be one of the lowest years of all time in terms of at-large bids outside the power conferences. Now, part of that is that if you're thinking about the power conferences, you have to include the Big East, so you have to probably include the AAC. So there are a lot of those teams that might be borderline are now in power conferences.
Right.
But, I mean, when you think about it, I mean, Murray State really, despite the caterwauling from some sectors of the media, really has no chance in that large, in my view, due to their terrible strength of schedule. Iona, you know, maybe has a little bit better case, but I don't anticipate them getting a bid. And so you kind of look at Wichita State as pretty much the only team from a minor conference that lost in their conference tournament that's a lock for the NCAA tournament. So it's going to be fascinating. You do wonder whether or not there's some bid stealers out of the power conferences, though. If, for example, UConn playing on their home court wins the American,
yep,
that would be a perfect example. Or if a team like a Michigan were to make a miraculous run in the Big Ten tournament.
Which is possible
because they do have a great deal of talent. Although
the Big Ten isn't all that great.
And injuries have killed them, especially in the backcourt. But, you know, I mean, crazier things have happened. So I think that's where the bid stealers may be. But certainly we believe that Xavier's current position is pretty unassailable as far as getting into the tournament proper and not going to play in game. Of course, we thought that last year when we left New York and it didn't pan out.
Not nearly to this extent, though. I mean, Xavier was a legitimate bubble team that needed to win a game to even be in the tournament, we thought, last year. We thought they might have played their way up to the 10 seed at that point,
yeah,
but had they lost, they were almost definitely not going to make the field. This year, I think there's no question that they're in regardless, and I'd feel pretty confident that they're not going to be in that play-in game regardless either. And the other thing you got to remember is it's a little bit different this year playing these Big East games where a loss is to a top 25 team,
yeah,
as opposed to last year when the Big East wasn't quite rated that highly. So things have been a little bit different in terms of the strength of schedule and what those losses and wins mean against teams within the conference. Can we talk about the Murray State thing real quick? Since it's been, I tweeted about it and had people tweeting in the middle of the night, and we've been talking about it kind of for the past 2 days. Here's my thing. I don't have a problem. Part of Gary Parrish, he's been sort of railing on this the last 2 days. Part of his philosophy I don't disagree with, that if you feel like you'd rather watch Murray State than a Stanford or a Texas or one of these mid-level teams from a major conference, I don't disagree with that. Campaign is going to be incredibly, he's an incredibly fun player to watch, and he would be incredibly fun to watch in the tournament if they were in. But why can't we say that and come up with an idea to change how that happens? Instead of trying to act like this Murray State team actually has any claim to be in the tournament, when they clearly don't. They're not a good team. They're not a tournament team. They don't look anything like one. Look at the couple games they played, and yes, they were early in the season, but even look at the end of the season. They're playing teams ranked near 300 in the RPI and beating them by two. I mean, it's not like this was a dominant team even against the terrible teams that they're playing against, and they did nothing during the season to warrant the fact that they could beat a good team. So this isn't a tournament team. They don't look like a tournament team. Why don't we just say that? Why don't we just say we'd like to see Campaign in the tournament because he's a fun player, and then try to work to a way to get those small schools with a really fun player to watch in the tournament as a play-in game or something like that, instead of trying to act like there's a legitimate reason where the tournament selection committee is flawed if they don't let Murray State in. They're not a tournament team.
Strong take.
Thanks.
Powerful take.
That's what I do.
I would say that I would agree with you. I don't think they have really a claim to be in the tournament. And frankly, if the Ohio Valley Conference wants to ensure that their best team gets the automatic bid in the NCAA tournament, there's a very easy way to do it. Do it like the Ivy League. Have a playoff if there's a tie. But at this stage, I mean, you kind of have to look yourself in the mirror. They played Xavier. They got boat race. They had another top one.
Valparaiso.
They played Valparaiso. They got boat race. They beat Illinois State. That's a decent win. But if that's the best win on your resume, no.
Yeah, Illinois State's like, I mean, they're top 100, but they're up near 100. And they lost to Xavier by 29, lost to Valparaiso by 32, I believe, or maybe Xavier was 27, but you get the point. I mean, both of those games were just ridiculous. That's my thing. I just don't understand why on Twitter everyone has to act like, why are we pretending like there's a tournament team? Everyone's feeding that same narrative. Don't. Just say Campaign would be really fun to watch in the tournament. He would. I'd love to see him. I'd much rather watch him than Stanford. But I don't think in any way, shape, or form Murray State is a tournament team. Nor should we consider them that. And here's my other problem, is all the people that keep saying that Murray State doesn't have a fair chance, that teams won't come and play them. Quit whining about it and go out and play bye games the way Xavier did when they wanted to be a good program, the way Butler did when they wanted to be a good program. No one wanted to come play at Xavier when they were playing in the MCC. I mean, they got to this point by going out and playing bye games against good competition.
And I guarantee you that if Murray State wanted to schedule Stephen F. Austin, Long Beach, some of the other really good teams in that mid-major classification, they could get those deals done in the same way that Xavier, while they were in the Atlantic 10, went out and played Butler, went out before Butler joined them in the A-10. They went out and played Gonzaga. They got a home-and-home with Memphis. They would play home-and-homes with mid-level SEC teams. It's not impossible. Murray State had a home-and-home with Dayton 3 or 4 years ago. Right. I mean, they can get top 100 teams on their schedule.
And that's the thing. You don't have to go out and play Duke and Kentucky and Louisville and everyone else like Long Beach State will do every non-conference schedule. And yes, you are going to be screwed with your strength of schedule once you get into conference play. But that's why you work the RPI in the non-conference and you schedule top 100 teams like you just mentioned. I just don't understand why everyone's acting like this is a new situation for Murray State and we should all feel bad for them. It's been this way for years. We watched Xavier do this exact thing years ago. I just don't get the narrative that's being played out right now in the media and by fans.
All right, well, we're about 8 minutes away from tip-off of the second quarterfinal for MSG between the St. John's Red Storm and the Providence Friars. We'll be back with you after the quarterfinal day is done, either late tonight or early tomorrow, to recap Xavier's quarterfinal bout against the Butler Bulldogs.